White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 341.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the second pilot is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello, and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with Patreon.com. One long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. This week, I was invited by Left Bank Books of St. Louis, the largest independent bookstore in the area, to come and sit down and have a conversation with Charles Soule. Charles is a writer for Marvel Comics, for Indie Comics. He's done some DC work and so on and so forth. I was not able to record the introduction that the bookstore people did for this program. I didn't start the recording, unfortunately, until we were just about to get started talking. But he has just written and has just had published from HarperCollins his debut novel called The Oracle Year. And he was out promoting it, and so we got together in front of a live audience at the St. Louis Public Library on Tuesday, May the 8th, to talk about him, his work, and this new book. And they kindly had my books there too, which was awesome. And so I present to you my conversation with Charles Soule about all sorts of things involving writing, comics, and his novel. Enjoy. Okay, so I actually have it.
I
also have it on Audible, so I listen to really, really good performance. I like the, you know, I've got several books on Audible too, and there's so many factors that go into an audiobook being appealing or not. It's not, you know, it's not just the story. It's that the reader has to be a good fit for the material.
Agreed.
And carry it off well. And I thought that he did a really good
job. Well, that's good to hear. I have not listened to it, even though I don't know, I didn't audition, but I listened to samples from about six or seven different readers, and I chose this fellow Charlie Thurston because I kind of thought that he had, just as you're saying, the feel that would kind of represent the way I saw the book in my head. But the idea of listening to somebody read my own words back to me is kind of like, you know, like I don't know, it feels a little intense. And so I have not listened to it, but I've heard good reports of people who have listened to it, and that's good enough for me.
Yeah, and it's hard to quantify, too, you know. It's one of those things, you either like it or you don't, really. So.
Right, well, I'm glad you liked it.
Yes, absolutely.
Have heard nothing but good things about it, so hopefully that won't change. We'll see.
I've got like basically three tiers of things to talk about here,
and then we'll see.
Yeah, I am very organized, and I've already thrown away those other 17 pages. Remember, so this is the cream of the crop right here. No, but we'll also let the audience ask some questions a little bit too. Mm-hmm. But I have like three sets of things. First, just about you. You are described as a writer, musician, and attorney, which is an interesting combination.
Sure.
And one of the things I want to ask you is, are you still practicing law?
I mean, to a degree. I started my professional career as an attorney. I went to law school, which you'd hope somebody would do if they're going to be a lawyer, right? But I did. I did go to law school, graduated, and started practicing at a big New York City law firm for several years. And I knew almost immediately that it wasn't, you know, like, because when you're working at a law firm as a baby lawyer, you can look ahead, you can see your entire career by the progressively more senior attorneys that you're working with. And so you look at the partners, you look at the people who've been there for a long time. And that was not a life that I thought I needed to be in necessarily. So fairly early on, I started trying to develop a living in creativity, as I like to think of it. And so that was, it started with comics, but it has branched out into novels, finally, after a lot of trying. In somewhere in that time, which was long, I mean, I started writing my first novel in basically 2000. But when you take the bar exam after graduating from law school, often people will take a week or 2 weeks to take what's called a bar trip. It's like a vacation they take to decompress and kind of, you know, not study the law for 2 weeks.
Sure.
And so I did that. And on the very first day of that vacation, I went to a stationery store and bought a notebook and started writing my first novel in longhand, which is not The Oracle, it's something else. But like I knew right away that I was on a path that I maybe didn't want to be on forever. So I ended up working for the big law firm for a while. Then I went on and opened my own practice. I quit that firm and opened my own shop, which was great. And like, there's nothing wrong with it. And I was an immigration lawyer primarily, which was something that allowed me to help people and change people's lives very directly, which I liked. But you know, I knew that the written word was calling me, whatever. And so I was always kind of working on the side to get into this, and it was hard. It took a long time. I started that in 2000. It's now 2018, and my first novel is published now. I didn't get my first real comic, published till 2009. So it was a long road, but here we are, right?
Yeah, I was thinking it's similar to John Grisham, except instead of getting out of law to write about law, you got out of law to write about Wolverine and Star Wars and stuff.
That's
an interesting. More about that in a second. I also noticed that you studied Asian and Middle Eastern studies at Penn.
Yep.
I studied the same thing at Georgetown.
Ah.
I noticed you specialize in Chinese language and history. I just like James Clavell.
Sure.
So this is an interesting background, right? So how did you start out doing? Did you start out doing that as like your undergrad, and then decide to go into law after that?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I my family lived in Asia when I was in high school.
Okay.
So we lived in Hong Kong, and that's kind of where I got the bug. You know, there was a Mandarin class there at that high school which is where I started studying, and then at Penn, I knew I kind of wanted to study Chinese, and so that was my undergraduate major primarily, and then music composition was my minor, and then but when you get out, it's sort of. You know, that's a very specific degree, and it's not really a trade. So like many,
right.
You go to a trade school to kind of learn your, give yourself a career. And for me, that was law school. So that was my trade school, I guess.
Right.
But I still love the Chinese language and the culture and the history and all of that. And actually, that first novel I mentioned that I started writing after finishing the bar, that was set in 400 AD China. It's sort of a magical realist thing about the birth of Taoism. But... you know, it was also my first novel. There's a reason that's what's out and not that one. But, you know, maybe someday I'll go back to it.
I hear you. So, all right, other than your sort of first attempt there, how would you say that either your background there or in law affects your writing, your creativity?
I think that's, I mean, the law thing gives me a sense of structure and discipline and the idea of, you know, when you're working in law, you know, you'll pull, if you need to pull a 15-hour day, you'll pull a 15-hour day. There's a sense of, you know, you sit down and you work until it's done.
Right.
And that, I think, has served me very well, particularly in comics, because I'm known in comics for writing a lot of titles simultaneously being able to produce scripts very quickly. And that's been an asset. And I think a lot of it has really just been, as I said, you know, I know how to... You know, if this is the task I'm setting out to do on a given day, a given work session, whatever, then I sit down and I do it. There's not a lot of meandering, not a lot of, you know, doing other things, you know. So I think that's from law in particular. And as far as the Chinese stuff, I mean, that's more like living over there and being able to travel a lot and sort of having a perspective that isn't just... focused on one place where I grew up or anything like that. And I think that's hopefully reflected in the Oracle Year. Like the book's story goes all over the world and has, you know, it has set pieces literally all over the place. And I think that is partly because of how, you know, where I grew up and the places I got to see. And I was very lucky to have that background.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm going to mention that I'm sure that quite a few people have not read it yet. So I was wrestling.
It's a big chance tonight. It's right
I was wrestling this week thinking about this, about how to ask you stuff about it without spoiling anything.
Sure.
So we'll do our best in a few minutes to talk about it without talking about it, more or less. Okay.
Absolutely.
Couple other things. We got to talk about comics too. While we're talking about comics, what would you say that so far your biggest accomplishment in comics has been?
Staying in it. I mean, comics is a field that chews people up and spits them out,
absolutely.
Really. And I don't know if it's good or bad. It just is what it is. People tend to come in. It's hyper competitive to get in. I mean, I think of it almost like the analogy I use a lot is is music, right? Because I have a music background too. And so there's all these bands who are all kind of scrambling for their time in the spotlight, but there's only one, there's only so many bands that can be the top. And that is what comics sort of is. Everybody's trying to make sure that their voice is the one that gets out, that gets recognized. The way that you get a job writing for DC or Marvel Comics is by essentially making your own independent comics for a while. And those tend to have much smaller audiences. You're not writing about Darth Vader, you're not writing about Wolverine right. or Superman or whatever. You're writing about characters that you make up. And so the big two editors consider it almost like a proving ground, like a way of winnowing out the people who don't want it enough. Mm-hmm. And getting through that is like it'll suck you dry if you let it. And for me, I started trying to get into comics in around 2004. As I said, I had my first published comic, a book called Strong Man, out in 2009, and then I didn't start writing for the big two with my Swamp Thing run for DC until 2013. Mm-hmm. So all in all, it was 9 years of extremely focused effort before I really got in.
Yeah, I'm friends with quite a few comics professionals sure. going back to the 70s, and mm-hmm. I know there's a number of them that don't even work right now.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, big time names.
Absolutely.
That when I was a kid, they were just gods yep. to me, and they're yep. not working. So it really is a, mm-hmm. a competitive thing, no doubt about it. So, you wanted to write. You got out of law school. You decided you wanted to be more creative.
Mm-hmm.
Was it that the opening came in comics sooner than novels, or how did you end up doing so much more in comics than
sure.
than
I mean,
novels?
It's really not that... when I wrote that first book, The China Book, finished it, got an agent, which I was, it's hard. As you know, like getting an agent is a real, that's a hurdle that
Absolutely.
If you can't get past that hurdle, you're not getting published, really. I mean, it depends on how you do it, but generally speaking, traditional publishing, you need an agent.
Right.
So I got one, and he took the other book out, Lennon 10,000 Things. And I was like, well, this is what's going to change my life, right? Because I was still working at the big firm at the time. It was happening over the summer, and I was like, if this goes, then I can quit the firm, And then it didn't get picked up. He took it out to editors, and everybody passed basically. And so that was very sobering. I was about halfway through my second novel at the time, and I finished it, and I brought it to the same agent, and he's like, he gave me some notes. And then I executed those notes, and I brought it back to him. I'm like, I think this is really strong. And he's like, you know what? I think so too, but I'm leaving the agenting field.
Oh, no.
Like, I'm doing something else. And so, good luck. I'm like, well, wait a minute. Like, who's my agent now? He's like, well, you have to start from scratch.
Oh,
you need to find, you have to go through the whole thing again and find a new agent. I'm like,
man.
And at the same time, I had been going, because I had, friends in comics and stuff, and I'd been going to comic conventions, and what I realized is that you don't need an agent to get a job in comics, you just need a great idea.
Mm.
And it's something where you can self-start, you can make yourself into something in a way that doesn't require gatekeepers to the same degree.
Right.
So I was like, you know what, I'm just going to try that for a while. And so I did, and when Strong Man got picked up, and then that started to get more traction, like, you kind of go where the energy is. And the energy was clearly in comics for me for a while. And then when I had a significant platform in comics, which was, hopefully that doesn't go away anytime soon, I was like, maybe I'm going to circle back to novels, because that's where I started. That's what I'd like to be doing. And I had enough of a fan base that the people who wouldn't have looked me in the eye before were all of a sudden going to take me seriously, a little bit more seriously. Nobody takes me that seriously. And so it just went from there.
So you had to carve out time. You're taking on a very big comics writing load. It seems
yep.
like you're doing
yep.
quite a bit.
That's right.
But you still had to find time to write a novel at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
How much of a challenge was that, and how are you able to execute
it? I have this saying that's I've been saying for years, because it's whether you take on another comic series, whether you have, whether you're doing law work, whether you're, doing stuff with your family, whatever it is, you always just sort of, just fit it in around the edges. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I tell myself. It's just around the edges. And so I guess in my life there's a lot of edges,
yeah.
and I'm just
yeah.
putting things
be, right?
in around them to make it work. But it's sort of, every day you have a list of what you want to get accomplished, and then you have a sense of what I'd like done in this week and this month and this year. And so I always have those things kind of pinging in the back of my head as far as what I'd like to get done. And so, free time for me is not a real thing really right now, unfortunately. If I'm not working, I feel like I'm not working toward what I'd like to be doing, which
exactly.
is kind of a
exactly.
It can be grueling sometimes,
yeah.
But I also, you know, it's sort of paying dividends too. So
right. Yeah, you almost start feeling guilty that you're not accomplishing and moving the ball forward when you're doing anything other than writing. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. No.
But I mean, and writing is a blast too. Like, I mean, the stuff I get to write, I mean, I'm extremely lucky. I'm extremely fortunate. So it's not like pulling teeth.
I've got to squeeze this comics-related question in that one of my podcast listeners asked me that I thought was pretty funny, because they knew your background as an attorney, mm-hmm. and they know that you've written She-Hulk and Daredevil.
Right.
Right? So the question is, who's the better lawyer, She-Hulk or Daredevil?
Well, it depends on what series you're writing, right?
There
so
you
if,
go.
If it's She-Hulk, then it's definitely She-Hulk. If you're writing Daredevil, and then it's Daredevil. And I actually had a storyline in my She-Hulk series where they went up against each other, and She-Hulk won that one because She-Hulk's name was on the top, right? And I think I saw it over there, maybe. I don't know if you guys have it over there tonight.
I have the one trades one and two.
There you go. So yeah, it's great. But then now I'm writing Daredevil. I've been writing Daredevil for a long time now. And they've hung out, they like went to the bar in the series, but they haven't had another court case. But if they did, Daredevil would win because his name's on that
top. Right.
Book. So it's very
well that's like, yeah, when somebody says who would win in a fight, Hulk or the Thing, you're like, well, whose comic is it?
Yeah. I mean it's
right.
Yeah,
it's exactly. Whoever the writer wants to contrive to have win. It's
anybody can win anybody. Like,
yeah,
you know, anybody can win. There's a famous. I mean, she's much more famous now than she used to be, named Squirrel Girl.
Yeah, yeah.
And for decades, she was sort of like a joke character. Like she would pop up every once in a while, and she was known for like defeating Dr. Doom.
Dr. Doom, right?
You know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, but her power is she can talk to squirrels, basically, and somehow she, which is, you know, not nothing, right? That's a power, I guess. I can't do that. but Dr. Doom's a heavy hitter, and so the fact that she was able to defeat him was kind of funny. Doreen is her name.
Yeah. Somebody on Twitter today asked me, like, who would you pick to go up against Thanos in the next movie? And I said, well, the two Marvel characters that are absolutely invincible are Squirrel Girl and Aunt May.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
line up behind those two. They're never going to die or be killed. That's right.
That's a good answer.
Are there any particular artists that you would like to work with? I know you've worked with some great artists in the past.
I've been really lucky. I mean,
who's out there, though?
Yeah. At this point, it's sort of... you know, I've worked with almost everyone on my wish list, which is kind of an amazing thing.
That's awesome.
One person who I haven't had a chance to work with, who I would like love to, is Chris Somney. He did the Daredevil run before mine with Mark Waid. He just finished a Captain America run with Mark Waid. He's kind of been sucked up by Mark Waid for a while, who I like a lot. Mark Waid is amazing. He's a friend of mine. But you know, he's definitely somebody I would love to work with. You know, I mean, there's a bunch. I don't know. You almost can't run out of extraordinary talent in comics, which is one of the things that makes it so much fun.
Well, I think part of it too is like what depends on what the property is, right? Because different mm-hmm. artists fit different properties.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. But if you're listening, I would find a property.
Yeah, you find something to work. Yeah. Let's talk about your novel writing a little bit, because we got to get into the Oracle year before I take too much time on the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When I write, my current approach, well, for one thing, is I've fallen in love with Google Docs because I can write on it anywhere.
Yeah,
I can write on my phone. I can be sitting in the movie theater during previews and I can be writing on a book, right?
Yep.
I wrote half of Vegas Heist on my phone sitting around.
Great.
But in terms of like you get an idea, mm-hmm. are you one that kind of like Stephen King just goes with it? Do you kind of come up with a plan, an outline? Kind of like what's your procedure leading you along the path there?
Right. Well, I think it starts with, it'd maybe be fun to write a book about somebody who could see the future. Maybe it'd be fun to write a book about this or that. And you have the seed of an idea. But then it's about not every idea is worth the extraordinary effort involved in turning it into a novel.
Right.
And you get a sense, and I think you would probably have the same thing. Like I have a stack of log lines, you know, mile high, but that doesn't mean that all of them are as good or will bear fruit in the way that a novel needs to. And the last thing you want to do is find that out when you're halfway through the novel. because what a drag, right? So what I tend to do, I do a lot of work in longhand. A lot of my planning work is in longhand. I have a ton of notebooks, you know, Moleskine notebooks. I have a lot of them, and I use a different one for each project. They're all color-coded, right? So Daredevil's is red.
There you go.
So, you know, whatever. Darth Vader's is actually one I... This is name-dropping. I'll say it right now. But I got to go to Lucasfilm, their offices, to... when I was working on the Poe Dameron series I'm doing for them, like before that. And there's a Lucasfilm company store that sells stuff that you can't get other places. And so I grabbed some, like, ILM and Lucasfilm branded Moleskins and like notebooks. And so I've been very carefully parsing those out for the Star Wars projects. So so Darth Vader is in one of those.
Yeah.
So I have those, and I'll go places where I'm just sort of letting ideas go. So maybe that's a coffee shop, maybe that's the park, maybe that's a bar. And you just sort of sit there and you write and you think and you jot ideas down. And that's often when you can tell if an idea is worth it, whether that's for a comic series or for, you know, for a novel, because it just feels bigger. It feels like it's a little, I would say it's analogous to when, like, I'm not a great cook by any means, but I know some. I know people who are really good at it, and I think that when you're good at cooking, there's a lot of instinct that goes into it. You know when something's done just by looking at it. You know when it has the right feel to it. You know when the taste is right. You know when you put too much salt in. And that's how I feel about ideas. Like, you know when they're going to bake up right. You know when they're going to turn into something that's worth the time. But I don't think you get that unless you've done it a lot.
Right.
And that's, you know, so I'm fortunate that I've sort of pulled that skill together. I'm sure you have too.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, I think of it as the hopper, right? I just throw lots of little pieces of ideas in there and let them bounce around and bounce around. Every now and then I think, okay, where are these pieces bouncing around? Are they like Legos or anything sticking together?
Any cohesion,
yeah. Yeah, and eventually maybe you'll get three or four.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, like, the great example of that was how Joe Straczynski talks about Babylon 5, that he had an idea for a small thing where there was like Casablanca in space.
Mm-hmm.
Then he had an idea for like a Lensman style giant galactic war, and then these characters, and then one day in the shower, all of a sudden the three pieces all went together. And he goes, "Oh my gosh, it's the same story."
Showers are great for that.
Yes.
I mean, they really are. I think showers, and I like to run, and runs are really good for story breaking and showers.
It's always somewhere inconvenient though.
Because I'm not. That's right.
It's never sitting at the table with a piece of paper,
yeah,
right?
I'm not taking my notebooks with me into the shower.
Yeah, yeah. No, that would not be good.
Yeah.
So what, in terms of novels, right,
mm-hmm.
what author has probably been the biggest influence on how you approach writing and everything?
I mean, it's hard to overstate a guy like, you know, Stephen King, I would say is a huge, I started reading him in middle school, and I've read basically everything he's written. And I think that the way that he approaches high concepts in an extraordinarily accessible way,
yeah.
Is a big, big deal for me. And I think you can see it in the Oracle. Like, I think that influence is clear.
Yeah.
But I also love Neal Stephenson very, very, very much, because he's able to take, these sort of, like, really abstract, high-level scientific concepts and make them... But I was going to say accessible, but that's not really what he does. He makes them engaging. They're not always easy to understand, and they're complex, I just have a blast in reading his stuff. And then the other guy I think of a lot in terms of the influence in my writing is China Mieville, who is a British science fiction and fantasy writer who I just love. And he writes... There's a specific title for the genre stuff he does, but it's like weird fiction. So, like, you know, you'll have starfish people talking to mosquitoes, and like,
yes,
it's all over the map, but it comes together in a way that's very just engaging and great.
And, you know, that's an interesting thing that I noticed about this book, just still speaking in vague terms, is that and it's reflected in where it's shelved. I'm not sure where Left Bank shelves it, but at certain other retail large multi-store outlets where I've seen it on the shelf,
yep.
It's not in science fiction fantasy.
Yep, I know.
It's over in like literature stuff.
Yep.
So what do you think about what was your reaction to that?
I think that's the book I wrote, so I'm glad to hear that. I mean,
okay.
I don't necessarily consider The Oracle Year science fiction in
right.
a, because I've read, you know, miles and miles of sci-fi books. It's my primary sort of genre that I read, I would say. But I don't think Oracle Year necessarily is that. I mean, can we talk about that? I'm gonna tell you guys what the book's actually about, right?
I was gonna ask you if you could kind of give how you would describe it, because
sure.
I have a hard time describing it.
Mm.
You surely can give
hopefully.
Us...
Hopefully, let's hope so.
And before you do that, what genre do you think it is?
I think it's in the same genre as, again, like a Stephen King or Joe Hill,
okay.
or even like a Brad Meltzer, like a very
right.
accessible...
But there's like a magical realism to
there
it
is,
in a way,
there
too.
Is,
yeah.
There is,
yeah. Because a lot of stuff is unexplained.
Yeah, on purpose, because I want to let you guys decide what
right.
happens.
Okay.
But the story of the book, in a nutshell, is you have a guy who has visions of 108 separate things that are going to happen over about the next year. And they're all specific times, specific dates, and just a couple sentences of a description of what's going to happen. And the first few of them start to come true. And he's like, whoa, what do I have here? And then the book's about how he releases them into the world and how he uses them, but also about how the world then reacts to the idea that there's maybe a prophet in the world. And he, one of the first things that he does is he posts the first chunk of them up on Reddit. And he says, you know, they're just sort of without any explanation. And then Reddit being Reddit, they start being tracked. And then as they come true, people start to freak out. Like, who is this? And then they assign it all to the Oracle. They don't know who the Oracle is, but the Oracle has released this information. And then once the Oracle is sufficiently famous, the guy who got the information puts on a new ad to the end of his prediction list saying, this is not all I know, and gives an email address. So the idea is you can write in and you can ask your question. You can find out what's going to happen about the future.
He gets a few.
Yeah, he gets a few. Because I, you know, for me, when I started conceptualizing this book, it was, which was years ago, it was during the time when I was trying to become a writer, and I wasn't a writer yet. And I was thinking how much I would give to be just be able to ask the question if someday I would be sitting here in this room talking to you guys, if I would be in a position where things would work out. Because at that time, it was a lot of like just grinding it out, working late, you know, trying to make this happen without knowing if it ever would. And so that was my question. But I figured that everybody in the world probably has a question like that. Not that question, but their own question. And so the idea that it would be possible to ask that question, maybe get an answer, that was one of those ideas that started having cohesion for me and started feeling like it was a story. So that's really what the book's about. It's about the way the world reacts to maybe being able to get those questions answered. And it's also about the guy himself and his sense of responsibility about what he knows, how he puts the information out into the world, and kind of how everything changes, why he got it. It's a pretty good read, I think.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. Did you think about doing it as a comic book since you've done some creator own
yeah
stuff
yeah I this has been a prose novel from the beginning, because you know it is so much of it is internal, so much of it
right that's true
deals with questions about destiny and people deciding what they're gonna do. And I don't know if I mean, so imagine a comic book page, six panels of somebody deciding what they're gonna do. That's not compelling. But if you write that in prose, where he's having the argument in his head, debating with himself, thinking about it, that then becomes something better. And so not every idea is a novel, not every idea is a comic book, vice versa. And The Oracle Year was always a book to my mind.
Your main character, based on anybody in particular, how much of you is in him, just kind of came to
yeah
you?
I mean, there's some of him in me,
because the musician thing,
yeah, maybe. Right, exactly. So he is part of the story for the guy, is that he's 27 years old. He lives in New York City. He's sort of a failed musician. I don't know. He's not a bad musician. He's an excellent musician. But it's clear to him that he's not going to be like a mega famous bassist, right? He's going to be somebody who sort of lives his life trying to get gigs and getting the studio time he can get and sort of like scratching it out over the decades. And that's tough for him to accept. And so when he gets these predictions, he's kind of like, well, he's wrestling with questions of destiny and like what he thought was going to be who he was isn't necessarily who he is and all of that. So I also have been a musician for a long, 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 long time. And the moment when I sort of snapped into, well, you're not going to do this, you're not going to be whoever, big time famous rock star guy, was when I graduated from law school. It's like everything, it was all that summer. You know, I took the bar exam, I started writing the book, and I like, you realize things, you're like, well, I've got these student loans now, like I can't go on tour, like this is a job I have to do. So there is a lot of that. There's experiences that he has in the book that I've had, there's places he goes where I've been as a musician and so on and so forth. But, you know, it was written from the perspective of somebody kind of looking back on the time when you're really wondering what your life is going to be and what you're going to do, and wondering how, you know, what your destiny is going to be, wondering if destiny exists, wondering if there is a pattern or a purpose for things, the choices you're making, what the impact of the decisions you're making now will be down the road. And for Will, any decision he makes as the Oracle, who this isn't spoiling too much, but his ability to say something and have a, I mean, if, you know, you think like Kanye West can tweet something and there's a big effect, like the Oracle saying something in this book becomes this massive world-altering right. thing. And so the responsibility of that begins to weigh on him very heavily, and he's not sure what to do. And so it for me, it echoed a time in my life when I was thinking about the choices I was making and how they would echo down through the decades for the rest of my life, and hoping I was making the right ones.
And big and small too. That's one of the many things I really liked about it was how, and again, I don't think it's giving away anything critical to say that his predictions range from the grandiose down to just things that seem utterly inconsequential.
Right.
And yet they all end up mattering to some degree or another. Even the ones that you think, well, that's just silly, you know.
Like, whatever. Yeah, well, everything matters, right? Everything that happens in your life, you know, the fact that we're in this room tonight is going to change our trajectory for the rest of our lives. Like, literally, this night right here, not just because we're talking, but, like, the fact that we're here. It could be anybody standing up here, but our lives will never be what they would have been if we hadn't come here. And so I wanted the predictions that Will gets to feel like that. And, like, there's a prediction about a dog breaking out of its yard to chase a squirrel, right? There's a prediction about somebody, like an older woman, having chocolate milk again for the first time since she was little. And these things end up having large effects, because small things do have large effects. The choices that you make, you know, am I going to take – is there Subway here?
Yes.
Okay. Am I going to take the Subway today, or I'm going to walk? Am I going to take a taxi? I'm going to take a car. Those things have effects for the rest of your life. Like, the rest of your life is different because you made that decision. And so I kind of wanted to reflect that in the book.
Absolutely. There's a couple of specifics about the book, and this is where I'm really going to try to cut around the edges a little bit, because I don't want to give anything away, but let me just see what you're willing to say. I'm just going to throw this out there, and we'll see what willing to...
Sure.
I'm not going to be the one to mess it up, right? We'll let you...
All right.
There's a character called the Coach.
The Coach, yeah.
Okay.
People like the Coach.
I was going to say, that's a character that I've got to imagine has been getting reactions.
Yeah. So the Coach is... So when Will, the Oracle, presents himself to the world, he does it secretly. He doesn't reveal his name. And because he's like, the minute people find out who I am, everything will be over for me. So he uses a lot of internet trickery and so on to hide who he is. So nobody knows. But there are many, many extremely powerful people who are very invested in the idea of knowing somebody, you know, who can predict the future. So you've got governments, you've got high-level corporate people, you know, anybody incredibly powerful who would want to know the future is after him. And so they call upon the best fixer they know, the person who can solve any problem, the person who can just sort of get anything done. And it is a woman in her 70s called the Coach. And the model in the book is Bea Arthur, but she's somebody who...
Okay, I can see that now. I hadn't really put a face, but there you go. All
so right. She comes across as very, like, grandmotherly and kind and so on. But then she, like, this is the part I don't want to spoil, which is because the way that she approaches problems is very
vivid.
Yeah. She's not somebody who fails, right? And this is an enormous problem, and Will has done a really, really good job of hiding himself, which just means she needs to do a really, really good job of finding him, and she does. And she's somebody who I've always liked the idea of extremely effective old people, if that doesn't sound weird. You know, there's sort of almost a little like subgenre, like a trope in fiction of elderly people, like Mr. Miyagi is a good example, like elderly people who have, you know, a lifetime of expertise, and they can use it in devastating ways. And the Coach is all of that in one Bea Arthur-like lady. And people love her. Like I knew she was good, but like she's the real standout, it seems like.
Somebody mentioned a while ago that there might be TV in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's
and
right.
And that's the character I didn't know that.
Yep.
Until tonight. But when I was reading it, that was the character I kept saying, this is a television character.
She'd be great. I mean, the book was sold. It was actually sold it was sold the week that the book was sold. So it would happen a long time ago. Like immediately it was taken out to both publishers and TV at the same time. And we had like it was really good. There was like a bidding war over it, and people really wanted it. And so the studio that has it is called Tamara Studios, and they are developing it as a TV show. And we've had a lot of discussions about what that would look like, whether it's like a 22-episode sort of procedural almost, whether it's something more like Breaking Bad, where it's like 8 episodes in a season on an AMC kind of channel or HBO or something like that. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, for all I know, nothing's ever going to happen of it. But people are working on it. Serious people, real people.
There you go.
And it'd be cool. I mean, I think we all would love to see that, right? Walking and talking, our characters like moving around.
Absolutely, yeah, no, that's fantastic. The other thing. This is, and again, this may just be that it's how you wanted it to be, but you've already said that Will posts his predictions or prophecies or however you want to describe them on a website.
Yep.
You said that. Mm-hmm. Okay. As the story goes along, I'm trying to figure out how to say this. You increasingly present that website as a character, or
right.
at least as a force.
Yep.
And I was trying to understand where that was coming from, because it's like Will starts to refer to it that way, but
yep.
yet we're never given any reason other than his perspective to think that was the case.
Right. This is one of the big twists in the book that I don't want to talk about too much.
Right,
but what I will say is that I do think that... you know, like, let's say Twitter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or Google, right? These are websites. They're tools. They're lines of code, but they take on it's anthropomorphizing, right? Like you think of them as things with their own will and identity. Like Twitter to me feels like it has, you know, it Twitter doesn't make decisions, but sometimes it feels like Twitter does.
For the amount of influence
Twitter has in my daily emotional state, which is much more than I should let it, but regardless, it does. And I think Google's the same. And there are other things that are just part of you don't, they're not real things, but you think of them, they begin to take on like a talismanic quality in your life.
Right.
And the site, which is what, so it's the site with a capital S, is what it becomes known in the world.
When you start using the capital S is when I'm really going... because I was wondering if I had missed something.
No. It's just a stand-in for the idea that there's at any minute. So the site begins with a set of about 20 predictions on it. Over time, more are added to it, and every once in a while, there's just one that pops up, another one, whatever. So at any minute, at any time of day, there could be something that pops up about you, and it could say your name. It could say in 6 months you will do this or that or whatever. And so people begin to check it every 30 seconds because they're like, well, what if something's going to pop up? I don't know what's going to happen. They keep checking. And so in a room of whatever 20 some people, every like half the people would probably have their phone out just in case, which feels like how it is, right? Like, I mean, you look around any gathering on the bus or whatever, like people have their phones out, the game. So the site becomes something that we're all thinking about all the time because we don't know what it's going to do to change our lives. And even if it's not a reference to you specifically, it's a reference to, you know, Missouri's going to be flooded, you know, and then all of a sudden your life is changed because of something that was predicted. And if that's something that's going to happen in 3 months, what decisions do you make based on in 3 months Missouri's going to be flooded? So it becomes crucial to everybody. And I don't think in a necessarily a healthy way,
right.
Which is the way I kind of feel about Twitter and stuff like that too. So as much as I'm desperate to check my Twitter feed right now.
Okay. Well, that reassures me then. I can see where you're going. That's interesting. Okay. Let's see. Last couple of things, then we'll see if the audience has any questions.
I hope so.
This seems like, well, I'll preface it by saying that one book I've heard it compared to by a couple of critics is Ready Player One.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I love this book. I'm a huge Ready Player One fan.
Sure.
I'm not sure how they're that similar in a lot of ways, and certainly not superficially, but maybe in terms of their spirit or something.
I think that the thing that people find analogous in the two books is the way that you consume them. Because Ready Player One is a book that you pick up and you blow through.
Yeah.
And I think from what I've been hearing, a lot of people have that experience with The Oracle here. It is very like each. So I used my comic book writing background to present each chapter with a pretty good cliffhanger. Like you want to know, like if I did my job right, every chapter is like, oh my God, I have to know what's going to happen next.
Right.
And that I think is sort of, it's different, but Ready Player One has that big treasure hunt at its core, and things like you just want to know what's going to happen. How is this going to all play out, you know? And I think that that sort of, I have to see how this ends, is true for both, much more so than any sort of writing style or thematic similarities.
Right, yeah, I agree with that. By the way, apropos of nothing, but I heard an interesting, I was talking about James Clavell a while ago, uh-huh. James Clavell quote, he said that people would see Shogun or Noble House.
Yeah, these 1,000-page books.
1,500, Noble House, yeah. And they would be like, you know, I just can't even begin and to think about it. And he says, I would tell him, give me 15 minutes of your undivided attention.
Yeah.
And if you're not hooked after that, I haven't done my job.
Right, I think that's...
And that's kind of what you're...
That's exactly right. I mean, in comics, you know, you have issue number one. And if you don't do it in issue number one, it doesn't matter how good issue number four is. Mm-hmm. And so... which is an extraordinary challenge, but it's something that it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, like comics is sink or swim, right? And if you can do that, if you could write that great single issue, then I think you can also write a great novel chapter. And if you're lucky, you can stack up 40 of them in a row and then you've got a book.
Yeah.
And so that's what I tried to do with the Oracle Year. I thought of each individual chapter as its own, not a comic, but its own individual short story mm-hmm. that needed to have a beginning, middle, and end with pacing that felt like a rise and a fall. And then you get to the last bit and you're like, I have to keep going. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, that's how it works.
My last thing, because that was leading into this.
Mm-hmm.
Is there another Oracle Year?
Was
that the only Oracle Year?
Right. I do have an idea for a sequel to the Oracle Year. That is not the next book I'm writing. I'm working on the next book now, which is about something entirely different. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, the response to this book has been like more than I ever would have expected. It's been phenomenal. Brought me to St. Louis, you know, mm-hmm. which is pretty great. But we'll see. I also think that it's sort of... As somebody whose novelist career is just beginning, I don't necessarily want to write the same thing over and over again. I want to suggest that I can write things with different vibes. And then if I want to and if I need to and if it makes sense, I'll circle back to the Oracle Year. But if I do, the idea that I have has a lot of the coach in it. So.
Well, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's see what you folks out there have to ask Charles about basically anything at this point. Yes, ma'am.
What are a couple questions that you'd like a book club to discuss about your book?
I would say, and this is a little spoiler, but hopefully not too bad, the ending does not answer every question that might be posed by the story. And so I think that's worth talking about. Like, why did I make that decision? Is it more or less effective? And what are the answers to the questions that I didn't answer? So I think that one's an obvious one. I think another, I tell the story through the point of view of about, I don't know, probably 10 different characters. And so it's all split up. It's like a Game of Thrones book. And so you get to see it through all these different points of view, if I tell you why, then the book club wouldn't really want to discuss it. But there was a very specific reason I chose to do that, why to tell it that way as opposed to only from the point of view of the prophet or something like that. And so maybe that would be another one.
Sure. I thought you chose to end it that way so that I would go, but come back, what did he do?
Yeah, I know. And I wrestled with it, and I have an answer to the question that isn't answered.
Oh, there you go.
I know exactly the answer, but I chose not to put it in the book purposefully, because I just thought it's better without it.
You, I won't say what, but you do a fake out though at one point.
I do. Mm-hmm.
He does a fake out. He's like, oh, here's the answer. Oops, no, that wasn't the answer.
Yep.
So I was like, oh, I fell for that one. That was good.
Well, that's good.
Well,
I mean, that's why.
That was well done.
That's why I did it.
That's right.
So,
very good.
Anyway, any other questions? Sir?
You mentioned several times that it's looking into a TV property.
Yep.
Given that this concept of the Oracle Year lends itself horrifically easy to episodic television, whether it be basic cable or standard network television. Have you ever thought of, if this takes off, of pulling a Joe Straczynski and saying, hey, these are my characters, my narrative, I'm going to write the scripts myself?
Well, I'm an executive producer on the show, if it exists. So if a show exists, I will have a role that allows me to, hopefully, have a role in sort of how the story goes. The Hollywood has this weird it's like a chicken and the egg problem, right? Like, they won't let you write a bunch of stuff unless you've already written a bunch of stuff. and for me, I mean, I've written screenplays and things like that, but nothing that I've sold. Like, the vast majority of my writing so far has been in comics and in you know, the Oracle year. So it's like you kind of have to, like, if you're going to sell, like, the Oracle year or the next book or whatever to Hollywood and say, I'm going to be Joe Straczynski, I'm going to do all of it, they need to, you lose things. Like, the deal's not as good. They will take things away in exchange for that privilege. So that's where it is now, but I don't know if it'll be that way for the next one, because hopefully by the time of the next one, I will be in a better position. So we'll see. But I think that having someone else adapt your work is a really, like, you never know. You never know how they're going to do it. If they're going to have the complexity that you brought to it, maybe it'll be better. You know, you just don't know. And maybe you'll hate it. Like, Stephen King infamously hates the Stanley Kubrick version of The Shining, which I think is amazing. Like, I love that movie. It's one of my favorite horror movies of all time.
You just spoiled the Ready Player One movie.
Right. I guess I did. But, you know, it's an interesting process, and I haven't, you know, I've had some other things that have gotten close to being made into TV shows. That Letter 44 property that was mentioned in the introduction got close, and so I read a lot of other people's takes on it, and they just focused on things, the wrong things, as far as I was concerned. So you never know. But at the same time, if that had gone, then it would have been really good for me. So you never know. Mm-hmm. So you got a question over there?
Back here, had one.
It took a while. You know, books, because you don't write a book once, you write a book like five times, and I'm sure you know. Because when you write it, you have a lot of ideas over the course of the process that you didn't have when you started. And so then you need to go back and put them in. And then your editor or your agent was like, well, you know, what if? And then you have to figure that out. And then sometimes you're just like, this is terrible, and you just scrap half of it and you start over. So it takes a long time. Took me several years to get into this form, but that wasn't all at once. Like, I would work on it for 4 months, then I would put it away for a while.
You know, I wanted to ask you, did it end up in anything like the form you thought it would at the beginning, or how did it morph along the way?
It morphed as far as the points of view that I chose to tell different story points through.
Okay.
You know, the importance of different characters, the way different characters work, like Lee Shore, who is the journalist character in the story, ended up having a very different arc than she did originally.
Hmm. Interesting.
Reverend Branson, the televangelist, had a different story. So you don't always know. I think part of that is that I started writing this book, like an initial, the early forms, the early outlines and stuff, before I had years of extremely focused comics writing, which is it's all storytelling, right? So the comics work has given me a very, like, it's, you know, my instrument is very, like, good right now. So when I, now that I'm working on the new book, I mean we'll see what happens, but I hope I'm not realizing halfway through that, oh man, you know, I should have done this. Mm. but we'll see.
Yeah. This one.
My question is, so you're writing your comics, and, mm-hmm. you know, you're writing Star Wars comics with characters that have very distinct voices mm-hmm. already, and then you're writing X-Men comics who has decades of
sure.
people that have written them, and then you're writing your novel where you are creating the voices. How do you transition between the two? How do you find that your writing is different when you're writing someone else's voice mm-hmm. and when you're writing your own?
Sure, or even creator own comics. You know, right. Curse Words, I think you have a couple copies of the first volume of that over there. You need to know who they are. They need to be real people, whether they're Wolverine or whether they're, you know, Wizard or Will Dando, the Oracle. And so if you don't know that, then you can't write them. And I think if you don't, they'll feel hollow and like two-dimensional and kind of crappy. So either you already know them because it's like Professor X, and I've known who Professor X was since I was little, or you spend the time getting to know them, and you think about who they are and why they're making the choices they're making, and you know, and Will, like, I know Will Dando really well at this point because part of me was Will Dando, and part of me just spent a lot of time thinking about why he's making the decisions he's making and the struggle that he's going through. So you just have to kind of do your homework. There's no shortcut, really. Mm-hmm. So I think you had a question.
Yeah. I'm wondering what your typical work day is like. How many different properties are you working on? What are they right now?
Sure.
When you get up, what's it like?
Right. Well, I don't know if you'd call today typical or not, but today, so today, I got up and I needed to finish a script for Poe Dameron, which is a series I read for Marvel about Poe Dameron from Star Wars. I also needed to do what's called a lettering draft on a series called Weapon Lost, which is part of the Hunt for Wolverine event I'm doing for Marvel. Letters pass is when you look at the art that's come in and you adjust your script against it. I had a conference call with Lucasfilm to talk about Star Wars stuff. And I did something else too. Oh, and I had to write a recap for an Astonishing X-Men issue. So that was today. And then I came in and I'm doing this awesome thing. And then I'll go have dinner later. So that is not atypical. I generally have one big chunk of writing that I need to get done in a given day. And then around that is a lot of answering emails. Maybe I'll do, a lettering pass is not significant in terms of time. Whereas writing a script, which sometimes I have to do all of it in a day, will take four to 6 hours of really focused time. So that, but the day I just, today is not super atypical as far as the way I would spend it.
Cool.
Yeah. What is your writing style relationship with the artist? Do you have like Marvel method anymore, or do you just give them a script?
People, it depends, right? So like, again, to go back to the Poe Dameron script that I was working on today, There was a sequence where it was a sort of a debate between the Poe Dameron comic is about a group of Starfighter pilots that work with Poe. They're all in the Resistance. I don't know if you know Star Wars stuff. Everybody knows Star Wars stuff these days, right? So it's a bunch of X-Wing pilots and they're going off on secret missions and having adventures, and it's great. And there were two pages that I knew needed to be about them arguing about whether or not they're going to do something, whether or not they're going to go and take on this tricky mission. And I'm like, listen, I could break this out into panels. I could, tell you, block by block by block who's speaking, whatever. But instead, I'm like, you do that, and here is the discussion, and here's who's talking, and here are their points of view, and here's what they say. And here's maybe an idea for how you could stage this so it's not just a bunch of talking heads, but it's up to you. So there's that. But then there's also panels where you want it, or a page or two pages where you want it to feel very beat, 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 sequentially, exactly this, exactly that. Focused on this, focused on that. And so those I will give an artist directly. And so it's usually, for me, a little bit of both. It's easier if you know an artist well and you can understand their strengths and that they're not going to, like the artist of Poe Dameron is this guy named Angel Unzueta, an Italian guy who is amazing. And he just can do it. Like, you don't have to worry about him. So I could probably do a full Marvel Method script and say, this is what happens. Please execute it well. And then I'll dialogue it later. But I'm a little bit too much of a control freak to do that very often.
With the Cold Lightning comic that I wrote that's being produced by Wendell Cavalcanti right now, mm-hmm. the thing I like about it is because he's so skilled at blocking out a scene and sketching it out. For a conversation, I'll say, you need this is the specific thing. But for like a battle thing, I'll say this character, and it needs to look awesome.
Yeah, totally.
And for that, mm-hmm. for an action type thing, the artist is always going to know, I think, at least better than me, maybe not big, how to make it look great.
You're right. And the only exception is everyone's, if I have like a really good idea for like, well, what if Wolverine did this with his claws?
Right, yeah. Something specific.
Yeah. And so you're, the way that I'll generally do that is I'll say it's a big fight, but here are the beats that, like a bullet point list. Here are the things that I think would be really cool because we haven't seen this before. So I'll give that. But how you put that into the page or how you execute it is up to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
all right. Any last couple?
I think. Go ahead.
Pick one.
Yeah, you've touched on this a few times, but I'm wondering if you could be a little more explicit in terms of from A to Z on a Oracle year. And okay, here's the story. Here's where I want to end up. It sounds like it morphed a little bit at different times.
Mm-hmm.
But when you started it at A, did you have something in your head that was going to get to Z?
Yes and no. I think that the version of it that I thought I was writing turned out to not be the book I wrote, but I didn't know that, and I couldn't have known that until I had written a lot of it, which is a process that I think is not uncommon for novelists, because novels are, you don't write them in a week, you write them over most of a year usually, and so you change as you're writing it, and the things that are happening in the world change as you're writing it, and your sense of what's important about the story and who these characters are definitely changes over the course of it. So, I haven't written that many novels, but I think I know, like, the new book, where what I thought it was about had it took a real dramatic left turn about a third of the way through of writing it. Like, I realized, and it was always there. Like, it was what the book was, it was always about that. I just didn't know it until I got a little of the way through it. The Oracle Year was the same way. And sometimes you know, it reveals itself to you. It's this weird mystical process that it's very hard to, like, sort of quantify. But until you're in it, you know, you don't know. That's how it is with me anyway.
Paul, do you have a question?
I have kind of a two-pronged question.
Let's do it.
Tied together with
the handle?
Comics and lettering.
All right.
Are you familiar with a comics property that started off being called Wolf and Bird, Counselors of the Macabre, and morphed into Supernatural Law?
You know, it rings a bell, but I don't know that I could say more than that.
Because as far as I can tell, the depiction of the law in that is quite good.
Yeah.
It's interesting, considering they're talking about ghosts and vampires.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And then the other is, what's your opinion of the depiction of Matt's lawyering in the Netflix Daredevil?
Oh, Daredevil? It's good. What I like about it is that they get a lot of the feel of being a young lawyer, just starting your own office, right? When you literally take anyone who walks in the door because you're so desperate for clients, you're desperate for somebody to pay you for being a lawyer. And a lot of times people can't really pay you for being a lawyer, and so you do get paid in bananas or whatever they're whatever
right,
they pay
yeah.
you in. But it's good. I mean, there are a lot of lawyer comics fans, and they have blogs, they talk about superhero law, they discuss law as it's applied in the Marvel or the DC universes, things like that. And they have had a field day with me, because I'm, you know, I'd like to think I'm a decent lawyer, but I'm not, you know, Matlock, right? I'm not, like, perfect at every aspect of law, no matter what comes across my desk. Like, I have my specialties, like every lawyer does. And so, like, I've never really been a litigator. I never really spent a lot of time in court, for example. You know, I don't know a lot about, I don't know, there are personal injury, whatever. Like, there's a lot of things I don't know a lot about. But the courtroom stuff is what people often think of when they think of a legal drama. And so you have to write it. You have to do those scenes. And so I do my research, I do my homework, but I'll get stuff wrong procedurally, generally speaking. So you'll hear from, well, I work in the Cincinnati, you know, state court system, and I, you know, whatever, city court, whatever, and I know that this isn't where this person sits, and they sit over on the other side of the room. And if you had only done your homework, you would have gotten that right. I'm like, yeah, man, cool. So it's it can be tricky, but, you know, whatever. They do it out of love, I guess. You know, lawyers, you know how they are.
That's true of almost any, you know, avocation, that they're going to want to say, well, I know that, and I'm going to point out to you where you're making a little mistake
yeah.
or something, just
yeah,
about
yeah,
any field.
And that's correct. Yeah. yeah.
Any other?
Yeah. No, sure.
You kind of touched on it already, talking about your phone calls with Lucasfilm, but, like, when you're working with Marvel, I mean, or Lucasfilm, have they kind of give you strict, you know, dictates about, you know, when you're writing the Wolverine comic, you know, don't use this person, you can use these six people.
Mm. It's more like, who do you want to use, and or what do you want to do? And that's true of both Star Wars stuff and Marvel stuff. And, you know, at the beginning of my time working for, not Lucasfilm, but for Marvel, it was more like, well, this is your lane that you can drive in, because we don't know who you are, and we don't want to give you keys to all the different toys. Keys to toys? Sure. And that's
works.
Writing.
Just go with
that's
it.
Writing, yeah. So then you kind of prove that you're not gonna I don't know, turn Iron Man into something he shouldn't be, or whatever the thing is, and then they let you kind of can do what you need to, unless a given character, like, might be dead or might be in space or might be involved in a heavy plot line in someone else's book, in which case they say, well, you know, so and so is appearing in this book at that time, we don't want them in both books at the same time. But it's never really from a, we think you can tell the best story with this X, Y, and Z, and that's all you could possibly use. It's like, what is the best story? You tell us, Charles. And then if we see potential issues, then we'll address them. And that is definitely true of Lucasfilm and Star Wars stuff. They usually, it's my guidelines are timeline and character, right? So timeline and main character. So it's like the Darth Vader series I read is set right after Revenge of the Sith, just like a moment after he gets into his suit of armor. And So that's a very rich time in Star Wars history that has been almost completely unexplored except for this Darth Vader series. And so they just were like, you know, do what you want to do within that time period. But that's where you are, and that's what the story is. Not that's what the story is. That's the space in which you're telling your story. So, and then I pitched a ton of stuff, and 90% of it is in the book, which is kind of amazing to me that they let me get away with a lot of the stuff that they did. But I think part of that really does relate to the fact that no other real stories have been told in this just after between episode 3 and 4. Very little of that real estate's been explored. So it's like a decade, or more than that, 20 years, 19 years, I think. So, sorry, I went on for a little while. Star Wars, you know, I can just talk about that for a long time. So,
I hear it's a big property. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What was your involvement in the cover?
They sent me an email with a picture of it, and I was like, yep. Okay. There were three examples, and I feel bad for your podcast listeners because they won't get to see this incredibly cool poster
we'll post
of the cover
something.
That they made up to me. There were three versions, and this was the one we all loved very much. The only tweaks were, I think this is terrible, but I'm going to say it. I think my name should be a little bigger. and then that quote was added once we got the Publishers Week. But otherwise, that's, you know, what you see is what it was. And it's been so eye-catching. I think that cover alone has done wonders for selling the book. It pops off the shelf. I mean, Left Bank, I mean, it does, right? Like, people can see it. So... and so I want to make sure that, you know, who I need to find, I don't know, and I should find out exactly the name of the person who did. I think it's Jeff. So I need to find Jeff and send Jeff whatever Jeff likes, whether that's a nice bottle of scotch or a box of chocolates, whatever Jeff needs, I'm going to send to him.
While you're talking about the cover, though, I was going to ask you that, is we were talking about that earlier. It's case wrapped, and that's very unusual.
Yep.
Do you know what the rationale was? It certainly makes it stand out different.
Yep, it was that, really. It was the idea was to do a hardcover that felt very unique, that felt very, you know, like a special thing. And the design from top to bottom was with that in mind. You know, something that doesn't feel like every other book.
No, absolutely.
Something
right.
That feels like it's a unique experience, and that again is going to just stand out, right? Like, and I think. It was sort of convergent evolution in terms of the way that they thought about the cover and the way that I think about covers, because I come out of this comic book tradition where your covers have to pop. They have to look like nothing else on the shelves. The logo's got to be super strong. I'm looking at comics over there now, like that I did. But, you know, you need to immediately understand what the book is and kind of what it feels like, what it's going to be all about. And the Oracle Year design, I think, does that perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a good combination. I mean, it doesn't immediately scream mainstream science fiction, which is what mm-hmm. you don't want it to do, right?
Right.
I mean, you want
right.
it to seem like a kind of a unique thing that could be in different,
yeah.
and kind of in different categories depending on how you look at it.
Yep.
So that's very effective. And it also just kind of hypnotizes you. It's like, buy me, me.
Jeff actually did
my head kind of goes like this when I look at it too long.
Yeah. He did an animated version of it that's sort of like, that is kind of like the Vertigo title.
Yeah.
It sort of spins out. It's really cool.
There you go.
Yep.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Any last questions for Charles? Okay.
Okay.
I have a question and a comment, actually. When you mentioned that the coach was sort of a B. Arthur character, mm-hmm. I had to giggle because in my head, you know, I'm the kind of reader who I assign a voice to it. To that character, and I really have to read it in that voice. The character that kept popping in my head was Roz from Monsters, Inc.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's a good one, too.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I just kept hearing that voice, so when you said B. Arthur, I'm like, I was close!
Yeah.
She has that very distinct voice.
She does. No, that's yeah. close.
So
I kept imagining one of the Downton Abbey ladies, actually, even though I think she's American, but still.
Yeah,
I mean,
no,
one of those,
that's good, too.
Those ladies from Downton.
Yeah, Helen Mirren, that's
yeah.
great. She'd be fantastic. I mean, you know, fingers crossed. Let's get all of them.
Yeah.
Probably that B. Arthur would be kind of a tough one
yeah,
at
well.
This point. But anyway. All right, well, I guess that's that.
Yeah.
Thank
right.
you so much for coming out and listening and all that stuff. You know, pick up some books.
Yep. Pick up some books. I've got...
Yeah, if you want me to sign anything, I'm more than happy to do it. And thanks a lot.
Three of mine are over there, too, and I'll be happy to sign them, too. They'll be selling them. I've got actually my Vegas Heist book, which is my new crime, my first crime novel ever. I went out on I'm a sci-fi writer, but I went out on a different angle. And then two sci-fi books. And yeah, and I want to thank Archon, Left Bank, and the library all for having Charles come out here and asking me to come out here. And it was great to meet
it
you.
It certainly
really
was. Thank
it.
You very much.
All right.
That was
thanks
great.
So much.
Thanks, everybody.
All right, and that was my interview with Charles Soule. I appreciate Archon and Left Bank Books and the St. Louis Public Libraries for making that possible and for inviting me and Charles to have that conversation. If you want to help support this and all White Rocket Entertainment Network programming, go to patreon.com, patreon.com, and just search Plexico or White Rocket. Or you can just, I think you can just go to patreon.com/VanAllenPlexico. Or you can always just go to plexico.net, www.plexico.net, for links to all of our programming, our Patreon page, and everything. We desperately need your support out there, our friends, our listeners, to keep our shows on the air, because we have a number of expenses constantly coming up, and you guys keep us on the air. For as little as a dollar a month, you can do your part to keep all the White Rocket shows, including the ones you like the best, on the air. I have to thank our patrons, of course, Joseph Fine, Christopher Burleson, and Samuel Salvatore, Phil Amthor of WeHaveDonuts.com, Steve Trawick, Richard Stevens, Justin Bean, Chris Usher, and Neil Dyer, David Evers, Tom Anderson, Timothy, Dan Thompson, Wes Atkinson, Steve Harlan, Andrew Barber, Jared Aldrich, Rich Reimer, Bill Matthews, Will Summerford, John McCune, Catherine England, Ann Congian, David Simpson, Josh Teal, Mike Finley, Randall Walker, C.T. Wayne, Earl Ricks, Dave Powell, Michael Kirshner, Mick Vigicana, Matt Rubenheimer, Chris Thrash, Logan Chilton, George Gaston, Tony Perry, Alex Nguyen, Clay Henson, J.W. Rice, Wardam Wade, Dave Medinas, Mark Squire, Joey Miller, Matthew Wagstaff, Russell Milling, Rob Morgan, Steve Schuster, James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Rains, Brant Rumble, Nicholas Craig, Patrick Williams, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, and our one-time and anonymous donors. And if I leave anybody off ever, please let me know. I don't mean to do it, and I want to get it corrected. We'll do a number of activities throughout the year that our patrons get to directly participate in, and only them. And we also have special features and early access to things on the Patreon website that come from White Rocket Books. And if the higher levels, you actually get discounts or even free material from White Rocket. So patreon.com, White Rocket, or just go to www.plexico.net. All right, the Rocket's going to get on out of here for another week. And we appreciate your support and your listening. And we'll see you guys down the road.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.